So missing who's ready to play. Buzz me, shim, fool. Watching you, chill, do what you told me how the world is made. She told me to walk this way. Talk this way.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Real vinyl.
Hi, This is Greg Keeler with Blue Rodeo here, 88.3 FM, WRCT, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Well, there's been another mass shooting, this one at a school, this one the deadliest school shooting since Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in 2012. And guys, this is not normal. Yesterday, I did a story about how we've had 210 mass shootings so far in 2022. And while I was doing that segment, I noticed that a 211th shooting had been added from Monday. So yesterday, Tuesday morning, I recorded that segment. And in the time from when I gathered the data to when I recorded the segment, a Monday shooting had been added to the list. So while I was talking, we went from 210 to 211 mass shootings. Before that segment published yesterday, a 212th mass shooting this year took place. Another teen gunman at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, killed his grandmother before going to school. As of right now, 19 dead. The shooter also dead. The shooter bought the guns legally when he turned 18. In other words, the law worked to the extent that this was someone that got the guns legally. And then we had this shooting. Now, of course, it's hard to know all the details so soon after the event. The details so far are horrifying. For example, one new detail is all of the deaths happened in one classroom in the school. Imagine the carnage that we're talking about here, even for the kids that survived. Unspeakable. As always, mental illness is being brought up by the right as the sole factor and cause here. And it's like a broken record, but as I've said before, the mental illness element is not an either or. After the Buffalo shooting, and now as well, we're hearing the right that doesn't want to talk about guns and availability of guns, talk only about mental illness. It's not an either or. Often there's a mental illness component. And if that's what we believe, we should make mental health treatment more accessible, more affordable, easier to get. Just about every Republican is against that. They will say when we try to expand access to all health care, including mental health coverage, these Republicans who say the mass shootings, which are an epidemic, are merely a mental illness problem. They say, no, but what you want to do is a government takeover of health care. What you want to do is socialism. So the first thing is, if they really want to deal with this as a mental health issue, why do they vote against every opportunity to expand access and reduce cost to mental health care? Number two, we have to say most mentally ill people are not violent and never commit any violent acts nor crimes. So sometimes there's the reaction from some in my audience to say even mentioning mental illness is an insult to the mentally ill. Well, it's not about being an insult. It's just that almost never do mentally ill people commit crimes or become violent. Now, for the small percentage that does, if there are fewer guns around, if it's more difficult to get guns in general, whatever violence mentally ill people try to commit will be less lethal. If the mentally ill people who would kill 20 with assault rifles can only get a handgun, maybe they only kill five. If they can't even get the handgun, maybe they can only kill one with a knife. You get the point. Okay, so even if we concede there's a mental illness component, well, we should fund dealing with it And it would still be better if those few mentally ill people who want to commit violence have a harder time getting guns. At the end of the day, this is an issue of more than one thing. Number one, too much and too easy access to guns. That's one piece. Number two, we have a cultural problem in the United States. In the United States, I don't want to say it's necessarily celebrated, although in some places it is. It's looked at as plausibly okay by too many people in the United States, that it's okay to use firearms to solve interpersonal or societal problems. Can't find a girl? Well, maybe you use a gun to go and do something. Disaffected by society? Having a conflict at work, the disgruntled employee shootings like we saw on public transit in California, what was it, a year ago, 6 months ago, 18 months ago? I don't even remember. So that is another component. There's a real cultural issue in the United States. And number three, there is the element of untreated and undiagnosed mental illness as a result of the disastrous healthcare system that Republicans refuse to fix. The same people who are saying the only problem is mental health are the ones who consistently vote not to expand access to mental health treatment. There's mental health issues everywhere. It's important to know. In the United States, there's way more guns and way more easy access to guns. And that's a unique issue in the United States. We also have issues with access and cost when it comes to mental health treatment. So there's violent video games everywhere. There's mental health issues everywhere. So when a Republican or anybody else says this is just about mental illness, ask what legislation they supported to fund mental health treatment, to make it affordable, to make it accessible. One other thing on this. You also have to understand the absurdity of Republican arguments about how limiting access to guns would achieve nothing. For years, Republicans have been saying, if you explain to kids how to have safe sex and you give them access to condoms and birth control pills, they're going to have more sex and they won't take the birth control pills correctly or whatever. And it's going to be more unwanted pregnancy. If you do that, you're going to get more unwanted pregnancy. They've said for years, if you have these harm reduction safe drug use sites, it's going to encourage more drug use and it's going to lead to more overdose. But then they want to say more access to guns has no impact on gun violence. That doesn't really make any sense. But meanwhile, they say if you ban abortion, you'll end abortion. Well, if that's true, why wouldn't limiting access to guns at least reduce mass shootings? Oh, no. That's different. Nothing will work to stop this. Say people in the only country where this regularly happens. Well, hey, that doesn't make sense. We've really tried nothing, but we're out of ideas. The only thing we have is arming teachers, which we're going to get to in a moment. Aren't we at the point where it's worth trying some gun safety regulations along with other things just to see if it's work? Do what many other countries have done with great success and see if it works here. I mean, parents had to provide DNA samples because their kids' bodies were mutilated beyond recognition to try to figure out, who are these dead kids? We can't even talk about gun safety regulations. And now they're back on the armed teachers train, which I want to talk about next. So I hate to break it to many of the people in the audience who think that just more guns in more places will make everybody safer. But there was at least one armed officer at the school in Uvalde, Texas yesterday where this horrible mass shooting took place. There was at least one armed officer there who was unable to stop the incident. OK, so what Republicans are now going to is no. This isn't about guns or gun safety or whatever. We need more guns in schools so that the teachers and the administrators and the janitors and the whoever can protect the kids. Let's go to some examples from yesterday. This is the immediate aftermath of the shooting in Uvalde, Texas. Asked on Newsmax how he would deal with the school shooting problem in Texas, the Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton said, well, let's arm the teachers.
As you well know, the state of Texas, not a stranger to shootings that either begin in schools or wander into schools. I know your team has dealt with this before. What were some of the solutions? And I know that Governor Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Patrick have also come up with task forces to harden these
task forces. And guys, what about the guns?
Schools, so they're not easy targets, easy prey
targets
for crazy people who go nuts with firearms. What can you tell us has been...
Remember, crazy people who go nuts with firearms. Well, I'd rather have crazy people who go nuts with a knife than with assault rifles. That's just me.
Talked about in the past, what has been implemented and what hasn't been?
Yeah, sadly, this has happened again, and it's a horrible tragedy. But the types of things that we talked about, and I'll never forget it after the Santa Fe shooting, was having one point of entry, making it more difficult for people even to get in that point of entry, make sure that they and having potentially teachers and other administrators who have gone through training and who are armed, because
teachers and administrators who have gone through training and who are armed, they're all on this bandwagon. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick went on Tucker Carlson's show last night and said, let's harden the targets.
We can do a lot of things, and Texas has done a lot of things after the Santa Fe shooting. Obviously, we have to do more. We have to harden these targets so no one can get in ever except through one entrance. Maybe that would help. Maybe that would stop someone. But it's really bigger than that, Tucker. We're a core society. We're a society that's just at each other's throats all the time. And we're better than this as a nation.
We have to harden targets. Schools now, they have to be hardened. And at least Dan Patrick is getting at the fact that there is a cultural component here, although he would say it's just political disagreement. If the liberals would just let us ban abortion and put guns everywhere and make taxes on the rich zero, actually, part of the problem is the gun culture of the United States. Radical Republican Texas Senator Ted Cruz said, "Oh yeah, you've got to just arm the teachers, and rather you've got to have more armed cops there."
We know from past experience that the most effective tool for keeping kids safe is armed law enforcement on the campus. You know, inevitably, when there's a murder of this kind, you see politicians try to politicize it. You see Democrats and a lot of folks in the media whose immediate solution is to try to restrict the constitutional rights of law-abiding citizens. That doesn't work.
Yeah. And then lastly, a Newsmax host named, I believe this is Grant Stinkfield. He says, you've got to have armed good guys at the schools. That's the only way.
Well, folks, by now you have heard about this animal that went into Robb Elementary School this morning in the tiny, call it a border town, called Uvalde, Texas. This animal murdered 18 elementary school kids and 3 adults now. Numbers keep rising. My heart aches for the loved ones of all of the victims. As I watch the media today play out its wall-to-wall coverage of the shooting, they only seem to talk about guns, deranged, violent individuals, and how we keep guns out of their hands. If you want to save lives, you can talk about that. It's important. But the number one issue that needs to be discussed is, how do you stop a gunman the moment he comes calling? The answer is secure our schools. It's still not happening. And in my opinion, institute programs where school faculty can carry in school after going through in-depth training on a voluntary basis.
Yeah. So listen, there are reports that 2 Uvalde police officers and a school resource officer fired at the shooter, but weren't able to stop him from entering the building. That's one report. We're still working on confirming that. But at minimum, according to Eric Estrada from the Texas Department of Public Safety, there was at least the school district police officer who worked at the school and saw the shooter with a rifle, with body armor, engaged the suspect and was unable to stop him. So quite literally, there were supposed good guys with guns there and they still didn't stop him. Now, their reaction, instead of saying, well, maybe the problem is how easily the kid got guns, they say we just didn't have enough good guys with guns at the school. You essentially need an army there. They will not stop until it is. They would rather turn schools almost into like forward operating bases, reminiscent of the military, rather than restrict access to guns. And by the way, the people now they're saying, let's give the guns to the teachers. These are the same teachers that for the last 2 years, they've been saying these are the indoctrinators. These are the critical race theory teaching, irresponsible indoctrinators who are grooming our kids. Those are the people that now they want to give the guns to. It's whatever will justify keeping as many guns as possible around. That's the bottom line. The rest of the world looks at us like we're insane. And at some point you have to wonder, are we insane? When you look at correlation isn't necessarily causation. But look at this correlation between guns and mass shootings from the New York Times. The U.S. has the most guns and the most shootings. No one else is even close in guns. No one else is even close in shootings. Now, I concede we have a problem here with gun culture, but the same people that want to keep the guns around like that culture, so they're not going to solve that. There is sometimes a mental illness component, but the people saying that's the problem don't want to fund treatment for mental health. But might it not be worth seeing what happens if we limit the number of guns that are out there? And I hate to be so negative and cynical, but if nothing was done after 26 kids were killed in Sandy Hook in 2012, is something ever going to be done about this? I don't know. I don't know. Let me know your thoughts. One more thing I want to briefly touch on related to the Uvalde school shooting. We now are very familiar in the United States with this circle where nothing happens. OK, and I know that I'm sounding negative and cynical, but this is typically the way that it goes. You can start the circle anywhere. I'll start with the mass shooting. Mass shooting happens. OK. Explosive media coverage for several days, a week, a couple of weeks. Tragedy. Something must be done, but not too much because people need their gun rights and you got to stop bad guys with guns with good guys with guns. And OK, we don't want to do too much, but something must be done. It's a tragedy. OK, well, since you can't really get anything done because, oh, we can't restrict, we can't do that, we end with thoughts and prayers and there's vigils and all of these different things. OK, and then a little bit of time passes. And the more guns in more places, people get really defensive about doing anything to make it harder to get guns and to reduce the supply of guns floating around. So you get gridlock and nobody ends up doing anything. And then people forget about the last major shooting. Now, in this case, you know, when we say we're back to normal, the last mass shooting was like the last major nationally significant mass shooting, because there were a bunch in between, was Buffalo 11 days ago. So back to normal now means it's been like a week since the last major mass shooting, but we're, quote, back to normal and nothing gets done. And then there's another mass shooting and the cycle starts all over again, except it's just happening more quickly because, like I said, the last one was 11 days ago. We weren't even really back to normal. It's just now normal that there's been a mass shooting a few days ago. That's the cycle. And unless you break that cycle, sadly, nothing's going to change. Let me know your thoughts. Find me on Twitter at Deep Hackman. It just so happens that later this week, just a couple of days after the Uvalde, Texas school shooting, the most deadly school shooting since Sandy Hook in 2012, that happened in Texas. And later this week, the National Rifle Association, the largest and most powerful gun rights lobby. What they mean is gun manufacturer lobby. They work from the gun manufacturers to sell as many guns as possible. The NRA is having its convention in Houston, Texas. The shooting happened in Texas. The NRA is having its convention in Texas. And who is scheduled to attend that convention? Well, Donald Trump is scheduled to speak there. And Ted Cruz is scheduled to speak there, Republican Texas senator. And Greg Abbott is scheduled to speak there, the Republican Texas governor. Just days after the Uvalde mass shooting, these three Republicans who advocate for more guns in more places and say guns aren't the problem and we need more guns, they're going to show up and speak, presumably in praise of the National Rifle Association, which has been one of the most important corporate organizations, that's what they are, at putting more guns in more places, making guns easier to access, easier to buy, and allowed in more places in American society. How do they do it? What will they say? How do they justify their presence there? How do you justify the existence of the NRA in this context? This is a celebration of guns. This is a place that celebrates making it easy for people to obtain firearms and just about any type of firearm that they would want. By the way, guns will not be allowed at Donald Trump's speech. They may also not be allowed at Greg Abbott's speech. Now, they always like to say, well, that's Secret Service's decision. Okay, well, needless to say, if guns make everybody super safe, then why is it a danger to anyone? Even if it's Secret Service saying we don't allow guns around the president, if this is an organization premised on the notion that more guns make people safe, you would think the safest that the president would be around a room full of people with guns, because if any crazy bad guy with a gun thought to do anything, there would be so many good guys with guns there to stop him. Bizarre, all absolutely bizarre. It's very strange also, by the way, that when these events happen, all of a sudden the NRA also goes to our thoughts and prayers and all these different things. They're certainly not going to bring up their role in making firearms easier to access. And the cycle with the NRA is as follows. And as I've said before, the NRA wins whether there are lots of shootings or whether there are not. And here's the way it works. It's actually genius in a way. If there's no mass shootings for a while, which I mean, it's like this is the United States. There's always mass shootings. But I'll kind of qualify that by saying if there's no mass shooting that gets national news for a week, because there's mass shootings basically every day in the United States. But if we go a while without one of these major, quote, major mass shootings like Buffalo, Sandy Hook, or more recently in Uvalde, the gun rights people will say it's thanks to guns. The reason that we are not having that many mass shootings, and what means that many, by the way, it's a sick standard, but they'll say people are not going out and doing mass shootings because they know others might be armed. The shooters don't want to go out there and have their plans foiled by a good guy with a gun. Now, at the same time, they want to say that the shooters are all simply mentally ill. If they are simply mentally ill, they're probably not rationally thinking, well, I shouldn't go and do a shooting because there might be a good guy with a gun. Mentally ill people, if you believe their story, wouldn't be thinking that way. But regardless, if you have fewer mass shootings, they say it's thanks to guns. If you start to see more mass shootings, right, they say this is a reminder. This is evidence that everybody's got to be armed because it's so dangerous out there. We need more firearms. And then, of course, the classic is, if there's a mass shooting and there's a Democrat in the White House like Joe Biden, the NRA will announce Democrats and Joe Biden are coming for your guns. Ted Cruz is already saying it. Others are already saying it. They're coming for your guns. So you damn well better get out there and buy some more firearms. And then the gun manufacturers make massive profits. The gun manufacturers profit from mass shootings. There were record gun sales under Obama after Sandy Hook. Why? Well, it's dangerous out there. There was a mass shooting, so you need guns to keep yourself safe. And Barack Obama is going to try to take your guns away. And then it is rinse, repeat, time and time again. So are Trump, Cruz and or Abbott going to bail on speaking at the NRA convention? I don't know. As of right now, they're still scheduled to speak. What will they say? I can only imagine. We do have primary results from last night. The primary coverage was sort of replaced in a great sense by this horrible, tragic mass shooting in Uvalde, Texas. But there were primary results. As some of you know, Donald Trump's new obsession is his endorsement record. Now, I have to tell you, it's all kind of meaningless. Trump mostly endorses people that are already winning or incumbents or obvious favorites. And so, like, your record when you're endorsing mostly people that are obviously going to win, it doesn't really mean that much. But OK, Trump is obsessed with his endorsement record. Trump had some humiliating losses last night. I mean, absolutely humiliating losses in the Georgia gubernatorial primary, the Republican primary in Georgia. Donald Trump endorsed David Perdue, the former Republican senator. On the other hand, Mike Pence endorsed Brian Kemp, the incumbent Georgia governor. It's not normal for a president and a vice president so recently out of office to be on the opposite sides of races like this. But Trump endorsed David Perdue. David Perdue was crushed by more than 50 points. This is one of the most humiliating losses in recent political history among well-known candidates. Okay, sure. Often you've got an incumbent against a no-name and they win by 50. Fine. This is a different situation. This was actually supposedly going to be a real race. And Brian Kemp defeated David Perdue 74-22, a stunning victory for Kemp and a trouncing for Donald Trump. We then went to the Georgia Republican Secretary of State primary. This is a really important race. This is who controls the election in the state of Georgia. Brad Raffensperger easily defeating Jody Heiss. Trump endorsed Jody Heiss. Brad Raffensperger won by nearly 20 points. Now, Trump got himself some wins, without a doubt. Herschel Walker won, and et cetera. But two major, major losses for the failed former president. Now, some other important results from yesterday. Stacey Abrams won in Georgia. This was a formality. This was she was unopposed in the Democratic gubernatorial primary. Stacey Abrams will now face Brian Kemp in November. That's a really important election. And when we talk about what are some of the most important elections, there are so many in November. But we've talked about how Pennsylvania Senate could ultimately decide who controls the Senate in the next Congress. That's going to be important. There's lots of really important races. Florida governor Ron DeSantis running there. That could set the tone for 2024. Abrams versus Kemp in Georgia is a big, big deal. Now, also from Georgia in the 14th district, yes, Marjorie Taylor Greene easily won her primary. There was every expectation that she would. She had roughly 70% of the vote. Marcus Flowers easily won on the Democratic side. So they will face each other. That's a really great race to get involved in the sense that defeating Marjorie Taylor Greene, in particular after the defeat of Madison Cawthorn, it would be amazing. But as far as a general election, Georgia's 14th district is very red, and it's going to be an uphill battle. And then lastly, in the Arkansas Republican gubernatorial primary, as expected, Sarah Huckabee Sanders easily won. She's Donald Trump's former White House press secretary. She will likely win the governorship. Chris Jones won the Democratic primary for governor. And in November, it will be Chris Jones against Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Very red state. It is, you know, speaking honestly with you, it's difficult to imagine that there would be a real opportunity for Chris Jones there, but potentially another race to follow. So some humiliations for Donald Trump last night when he posted today to his platform, Truth Social.
Truth Central.
Yeah. He barely spoke about the ones that he lost, focusing only on the win. So not a major surprise. Next week, more primaries, which we will be covering. And all of these stories will have more coverage on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Daniel Levitin, who's a psychologist, neuroscientist, author, and professor emeritus at McGill University. Some of his books include A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking with Statistics and the Scientific Method, and also Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. It's really great having you on. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, David.
So, I mean, where to start? I think maybe one place that would be interesting would be for context. You know, we've recently been doing a lot of thinking about how to best engage in conversations with people who might have different opinions, but also importantly, who maybe don't have a factual foundation or basis on which we can have those conversations, or people who can't tell the difference between news reporting and conspiracy articles that might be shared on Facebook, as just general examples. One approach is to speak to these folks with like a Socratic type method of questioning, gently probing, how did you come to this conclusion? How do you determine if a news source is trustworthy? It's a very long process, admittedly, which sometimes is effective at changing minds and sometimes is not. Where maybe we would start with you is, can you talk a little bit about whether you believe that that's an ideal framework for some of these conversations, or whether there might be better or at least different approaches to pair with that?
Well, I agree with you that we've got a problem. And the reason that we are so divided as a country is we're not using the same facts to come to any conclusion. If yes. At least we have the same facts, we may differ about how we want to proceed from there. But without that, it's bedlam. And I'm inspired here by the work of Lee McIntyre, a philosopher who's done a lot of work on this. And I'm with you and with Lee. You can't reason somebody out of a position they didn't reason themselves into right. In the first place. All you can do is listen, understand, and try to understand where they're coming from, allow them not to feel judged by you. And then, as you say, ask questions about how they came to believe what they believed and whether they think, step by step, is this a reliable source? Is there another way to look at it? And as McIntyre says, and as you said, it's a very long and arduous process, but it's all we got for now.
there's no shortcuts. In other words, we've interviewed Lee, by the way, on the program, and it was fascinating. In your work overall over the years, you've gone to the micro level of how graphs are used to deceive and to lie. And you've also talked much more macro, sort of the way that we just started. Today for 2022, where it's rapid fire social media sharing of fake articles and it's truncated y-axes when you look at an unemployment rate or stock market numbers. I mean, it's sort of like an all of the above thing. Can we go a little narrower and specific about what you see as some of the most commonly used tools of deception?
Yes, thank you. And we are currently doing some research on this, and there may be some quicker ways to move the needle a little bit that we can get to later.
Mm-hmm.
Distorting graphs is a big thing. As you mentioned, a truncated y-axis where, you know, the y-axis is the up and down one, and it looks like you've got a really big difference, but they've zoomed in on a difference that isn't really a difference to distort it. People can say all kinds of things with graphs if they didn't label the axes. If they're not labeled with numbers or what the quantities are, you don't know anything. And my approach has been to educate. I'm an educator, to try and educate people about the different tricks and swindles. And really, I think the most effective thing to do is to start with 12-year-olds. I don't know that we're going to reach people my age who have already made up their minds, maybe not even people your age, unless they're especially open-minded. But if we start with 12-year-olds, in another 10 years, we'll have solved the problem.
Yeah. And, you know, when one says that, there's a particular group that says you're talking about indoctrination, when really you're talking about the opposite. You're talking about a toolbox for people to think for themselves rather than be indoctrinated into any particular worldview. Is that correct?
That's perfect. I've never sought to tell somebody what to think, just to teach them how to take a problem apart and how to think about it and form their own conclusions. And if they come up with a different conclusion than I do, that's what democracy is all about. Like you, I embraced that discussion as long as the process was reasonable and somebody wasn't tricking them.
When it comes a little more specifically to news consumption, which, you know, we can include radio, television and online, kind of all platforms, I'm going to use an analogy to what many of us do when we look at an article or hear a piece of news for the first time. One of the difficulties, it seems, in self-driving vehicles is that there are some decisions that we as humans make intuitively and quickly that are really hard to have a computer mirror. A classic is, do you go through the yellow light or do you stop? And we're at the same time calculating how fast are we going, someone behind us, the width of the intersection, all of these different things. And we're making these decisions very, very quickly. In the same way, many of us, myself included, similarly make decisions when we are first presented with a news article that we see somewhere. That's fine, I think, to intuitively kind of have that perception. But there really is a probably better sequence or toolbox that we can have to be able to assess for ourselves, is a piece of news or article trustworthy? Are the assertions accurate? What would such a toolbox look like? What would such a process be for the average news consumer?
Well, to begin with, I think we can recognize, although we don't all agree on this, that there are some people who are experts in certain topics. So if you want to know about climate change, talk to somebody who works in the field, somebody who is a climate change scientist. Don't talk to a geneticist or a biologist. A lot of the climate change misinformation has come from people who are not expert. And for that matter, if you want to know about something going on in the brain, don't talk to your foot doctor. I mean, he or she might know, but it's less likely. So I think the average person whoever that average person is, don't appreciate that there really are experts who know things. Virologists are an interesting case because we've, during the pandemic, seen a lot of flip-flopping. And so people say, oh, well, they don't know anything, or they're just trying to make money off of us. And the reality is, the second part of this is to help people understand how science works, because a lot of the information we consume is scientific. Science is a self-correcting process. They're flip-flopping as they should. When new information comes in, they update their views. The third thing we can do, I think, is understand that there's a hierarchy of information sources. None is perfect. None is unbiased. All are biased and imperfect. But what you want in an information source is one that will, like science, self-correct, print a retraction if it's wrong, check its sources before it goes with the article. So TMZ is a sort of favorite case of mine because they did break the story of Michael Jackson's death before anyone else. But they got lucky. For every story they broke that was right, they broke 20 stories that were not right. They've said that Miley Cyrus was dead, all kinds of stuff. And so I tend to trust sources that are a little bit more deliberate and circumspect. And everybody has to draw the line somewhere different. But I think we all agree there are sources that are just kind of capricious. They say what they want. And included in those, unfortunately, are, I guess they're not really news shows. They're commentary shows. People commenting on the news, which is not the news.
Right. And that goes to media literacy in a sense. I mean, it's being able to distinguish the difference between news and opinion. Sometimes I'll get emails praising me for being unbiased, and I'll say, I love that you love my show, but I am not a news show whose bias we really should evaluate in those terms. I mean, this is a program about my opinion. The problem is that there are media actors that are deliberately blurring that line.
Oh, for sure. It leads to better ratings if they say this is what's really going on. And let me tell you what they don't want you to know. And I have unique access to facts that you will never encounter. That always makes me a little suspicious.
You mentioned climate change and a couple of other things which I think lend themselves to this next sort of idea. There's a contingent that has placed itself seemingly above the fray in terms of some of these partisan disagreements by taking the position that they are, and this is my, it's sort of a pejorative, an enlightened centrist in a sense. They've determined here's what one side thinks and here's what the other side thinks, and I can rise above this and find the truth, and it happens to be sort of somewhere in the middle. So if you watch Fox News, you watch MSNBC, and the truth is between those two. And of course, the problem with this is with something like climate science, you know, if you say, well, let's bring in one person who says it's real and one person who says it's not. And the truth is, it's sort of like in the middle. This seems like a problem, this idea of the truth being in the middle, doesn't it?
I agree. There are two sides to many stories, but there are not two sides to a story if one side is a lie or a complete, you know, a fabrication or a distortion. That's not a side. And now that raises this thorny issue, well, of who's going to decide what's a lie and what's not. And that gets back to where we started. I think each of us needs to be armed to make that decision for ourselves. We need a toolkit. And I've written a couple of books that provide the toolkit, but lots of people have. I'm not here to hawk my books. There are a lot of books on critical thinking. And it's a muscle that you have to exercise. You don't learn it once. And then keep it, because as you say, it goes against our evolutionary bias, which is to make snap decisions rather than deliberate ones, what my teacher Danny Kahneman wrote about in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And so this enlightened centrist, you know, one of them that you may know of is called allsides.com.
Yeah.
Where he presents four different views, a left, a right, moderate left, moderate right, and an extreme left or an extreme right. And then you can decide. The issue I have, and I told him, John Gable, is that some of the stuff on both sides is really not fact-based, so it's not helpful. And they need to do a better job of sorting that out. And again, I come back to, well, as a rule of thumb, I would ask some experts. And if the experts disagree, that's fine. I would report that. But there are some things that experts really don't disagree about. The suitable experts will tell you that the measles vaccine does not cause autism.
Right.
The information that was based on was retracted. The guy was found to have fabricated data. Andrew Wakefield, his medical license was taken away. I mean, that's about as strong a case as we have, and yet people still believe it because there are two sides, they think.
You mentioned Daniel Kahneman, who wrote Thinking Fast and Slow, and much of the book is based on the work he did with Amos Tversky. One of the things that Daniel Kahneman writes about is that so much of our everyday lives is based on certain cognitive biases and heuristics that many of us, unless you really take some time to learn about them, you don't understand them. You know, availability bias. You're very much skewed to kind of what you see around you, as one example. Sometimes it's a bias to loss aversion, even when a loss and a gain can sort of be the same thing mathematically, but depending on how it's presented, it feels different. Which of those biases and heuristics do you think are most relevant when it comes to news consumption and what we believe or disbelieve or how we evaluate news?
You know, I worked in Kahneman's lab as a student and worked on some of the experiments, and I worked in Tversky's lab, and Kahneman was around a lot. And Tversky and Kahneman both said that this stuff is so hard, you can teach it to somebody and then they fall again a month later. And even PhDs in statistics were failing our little tests. Fiendishly difficult. I think we have to face the fact that we are all biased, as you have admirably done. We're biased towards, in a trivial non-news way, some people are biased towards wanting to live in cities. Some people like to live in the country or in suburbs. Some people want to take a vacation to the beach, some in the mountains. Those are biases or preferences, but hard to distinguish. When it comes to what we can arm ourselves with, yeah, Tversky and Kahneman have this inventory of like 50 different things. Availability heuristic, representativeness heuristic, the belief perseverance, all these things. I don't know that we need to learn those.
Mm.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
I find it entertaining too, and I would encourage anybody who wants to do so because it sharpens your mind immeasurably. But from day to day, I don't stop and think about that stuff unless it pokes me in the face. It's such an obvious example of that bias, either in reporting or in my own muddled thinking about something. What I really use is I look at the headline and I ask myself if it's even plausible. Does it just pass a simple plausibility test? And then I look at who's saying it and where they got the information, and that sorts through about 80% of it for me.
Yeah, and it's admittedly a very strange time because I think 5 years ago, a headline like "The former president was flushing documents down a toilet," we would all say it's not plausible, and that would be the end. But things do change, right? I mean, to some degree, we have to adjust to the current circumstances.
Well, that's a wonderful point. There's this arcane thing we call Bayesian inferencing.
Right.
Which is just a fancy name that statisticians and doctors and lawyers and judges use for if new information comes in, you put it on the scale. So, maybe the evidence for climate change was that it was just a natural occurrence. Maybe people thought that 40 years ago, and then information comes in. And at some point, the scales might be evenly balanced or slightly tipped. And the idea is, you have to stay open-minded.
Right.
You have to be willing to learn something new that may shake the very core of what you believe.
Is there a single question that you could leave us with that is the most effective at starting conversations with people in order to get them to have an open mind?
Some version of, I didn't know that, or I didn't realize that. Where did you learn that, or how did you learn that?
Right.
And then just follow the question and see where it goes. And again, don't try to shame somebody. That doesn't work. Don't try to say that their view is ridiculous.
Right.
Because they're going to shut down emotionally and become defensive. And we've seen through research they'll double down. But in our lab and in Gordon Pennycook's lab in Canada, a simple question of do you think that's reliable? Or where did you learn that? Or, you know, a lot of people say unreliable things. It could, I don't know. Tell me, could this be one of them?
Mm. Yeah. Another one that I think is interesting is, what would it mean for your worldview if this wasn't true? And, you know, with the Trump was actually the winner stuff, there's a lot emotionally wrapped up in the belief that Joe Biden didn't really win. And not everybody's willing to answer the question, but for a lot of these folks, it would be really impactful if their guy just genuinely lost rather than there was this major multi-state conspiracy to steal it. And but not everybody's necessarily open to taking that question seriously.
Well, it's difficult, David, because in one version of this story, what you have to realize is, oh, a whole bunch of people have been lying to me.
Right.
And I bought it. Am I that vulnerable and that gullible?
Right.
And am I that defenseless? What we see with older adults who get scammed by con artists is they don't want to tell anybody because they're embarrassed.
Right.
And they kind of don't want to admit that it was their fault for not asking the right questions. They'll just say, oh, well, this person lied to me. And I, you know, and it's true. Some of those scammers are very, very good liars. But in government and media, we have some very, very good liars, too.
That's true. That's true. We've been speaking with Daniel Levitin, whose books include A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking with Statistics and the Scientific Method, and also Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. So appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you, David. This was fun.
All right, this is super interesting. Yesterday on the program, The View, there was a confrontation between two former Trump staffers, the very well-known Kellyanne Conway and the slightly less well-known Alyssa Farah Griffin. They both previously worked for Trump at different points in time. This is a complete train wreck of a conversation where they start going at each other. Let's just jump into it, and then we'll discuss, because it is fascinating.
Do you want to acknowledge something you said last segment? I remember flying on Air Force One in October of 2020, and two very senior advisors to the president, Dave Bossie and Corey Lewandowski, turned to me and said, we would be winning this race if it was Kellyanne running the campaign. So I think that there's some real truth to the direction it went the second time around, and that perhaps you having a more senior role would have changed that. But I have to ask you something. We served together briefly in the White House my second time. I admired you the first time when I was working for Pence. You were very helpful to me.
What happened the second time?
Oh, the second time? No, I just meant I looked up to you. We were in more comparable roles. I was in more junior role the first time. I broke with the president ahead of January 6th when the big lies started being shared. I resigned in December 4th, and I spoke out after January 6th when I saw a violent mob assault the Capitol.
Is there a question in here?
Yes.
Okay.
How do you...
Is there a question in here? So it starts to get testy, and Kellyanne clearly doesn't like the direction this is going.
Do you still defend him? Do you still think he could be a good president after he tried to overturn our democracy?
Okay, so I left 3 months before you did for my children. I have four of them. And I said, less drama, more mama. And that's exactly what I did. I think you stayed a whole month after the election that you were having a problem with. But that's.
I wanted to help my junior staff get jobs.
That's good.
I stayed for 3 weeks.
I think people should know that because I haven't seen you since you've changed. But I want to say this to you.
I didn't change. Just to be clear, I didn't change. I swore an oath to the Constitution.
You get to talk here every day.
I swore an oath to the Constitution, not to Donald Trump.
I know. But Alyssa, I know that you. Right, as we all did. We all did, but and I appreciate that. I think there was a lot wrong with the 2020 campaign, and I think in addition to that, afterwards, your former boss Mark Meadows, who was a terrible chief of staff, did not match the moment.
Look at this. This is just everybody pointing the finger at each other for what went wrong. This is the rats abandoning the ship.
A global pandemic, a re-election campaign.
Neither did Donald Trump.
Excuse me. Protests after George Floyd's murder. He didn't match the moment at all, and didn't take advice from people.
But do you think Donald Trump matched the moment?
And then he allowed supplicant after sycophant after showman to come before the Resolute desk and promise the president that was the day they were going to find more votes in Arizona, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania.
So this is fascinating because Kellyanne is basically saying, it was Mark Meadows' fault that Trump ended up believing all this stuff about the big lie. It wasn't Trump himself. Now, of course, personal responsibility. if Trump, if this story is true, isn't it Trump's responsibility ultimately to vet whether Mark Meadows is really telling him the truth?
I
was on ABC, so I'll answer your question. Maybe you missed it. I was on ABC live on January 6th.
And
George Stephanopoulos. And I said, people have to get out of the Capitol. What are you doing there? Why have you reached the Capitol? What is going on?
Okay, but you still sound blue, but you're still supporting Donald Trump now.
Live on January 6th. Alyssa, if you're saying that somehow you think we're supposed to think that you've seen a light and not just see your name in lights. That's not fair. What do you mean I'm still supporting
you? You're not answering the question.
Let me ask you a question.
How is a man qualified to be president if he incited?
He's not the president. Joe Biden is.
I know, but you're talking about maybe a second term. You've never denounced Donald Trump.
That's
when he incited a violent mob that attacked the U.S. Capitol.
I did that day. First of all, I didn't.
But then you went right back to him.
Okay, so what we're going to do right now is we're going
to
move on because we're
going to.
Well, do me a favor. Do me a favor because we don't have as much time as we did. So do this.
I did like working with her.
I'm sorry, Kellyanne. Don't make. Go on.
I was on ABC News on January 6th.
Joy,
people get the hell out of the Capitol.
Ask your question.
And I don't want the 74 million Biden voters.
This is unfortunate, but we're going to go if you don't. If you can't let her do the question.
It's just really a follow-up to that question.
So a complete and total train wreck. And listen, there's a lot of kind of posturing here. In her new book, Kellyanne Conway tells some complicated stories about her involvement. And everybody now is essentially trying to rewrite history in the way that most advantages them. But what is very clear is that everybody's pointing fingers at each other and just a complete train wreck of a View episode. Interesting to see. OK, real quick, I don't have a ton of time for this particular story, but I think it's an important one to mention. We have a situation right now where the Republican Party is blaming Biden for everything, but actively blocking solutions. And this might not really be a shock to you. It's like, hey, David, yeah, welcome to American politics, particularly Republican politics. They're blaming Joe Biden for the high gas prices, but just about every Republican or every Republican voted against the crackdown on gas price gouging. They're blaming Joe Biden for the baby formula shortage, but they voted against a deal a bill that would actually deal with the shortage. And now they're saying put us in power in November, and it's terrifying, but they have a pretty good chance at taking over. So a couple of different articles here to look at. First of all, full list of 192 House Republicans who voted against the FDA baby formula bill. OK, the House last week passed a $28 million emergency spending bill to address the baby formula shortage. It passed 231 to 192, mostly along party lines. All House Democrats supported it. Only 12 Republicans did. And 192 Republicans voted against it. Hey, here's a problem. They claim to want to solve it. If you look at, for example, Elise Stefanik's, she's a Republican congresswoman. You look at her Twitter, Joe Biden owns this baby formula crisis. She's posting pictures of babies. She's doing all these. Actually, that might just be a picture of her own birth announcement. Yeah, that is. That has nothing to do with baby formula. But if you scroll down her Twitter, you see gas now at historic high, energy's Biden's energy crisis. Joe Biden never should have let the baby formula crisis reach this point. And then they vote against the bill that would deal with it. You look at the gas prices. There was a bill passed by the House to deal with gasoline price gouging. It passed 217 to 207 with no Republicans voting for it. And also four Democrats voting against it. They complain that Democrats do nothing. They blame Biden for problems. Democrats put together bills to actually deal with some of these issues and they vote against them. And sometimes they'll say, well, the bill wasn't perfect. And of course, no bill is. But this is not really just a problem of Republicans. What Republicans are doing is unconscionable. But we have to also say, where is the Democratic communications arm? It's like it's non-existent. There's no coherent messaging. There's no coherent marketing and PR strategy. Republicans are actively sabotaging baby formula, gas prices, all of these problems that there's at least an idea of how to not fix permanently, but improve upon. And Republicans are getting in the way of all of it. And unfortunately, Democrats are not coherently united with a cohesive strategy to say, look at what they're doing. Look at what they're doing. One last thing. There's a lot of criticism of how, despite controlling the Senate, Democrats can't get a lot of stuff passed. I think it's important to understand that when most things need 60 votes in the Senate, if you have 50, you don't really control it. Sure, you control the agenda. And if there's a tie on something that you need 51 votes for, Kamala Harris can make that 51st vote. But when you need 60 votes, it's a bit of a misnomer to say you control the Senate. You can control the agenda. And I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here's a 17-year-old kid who called in who says, I've grown up being afraid of being shot in school because of these mass shootings. Listen to this.
Hi, David. It's August from Wisconsin. And I'm just here to talk about the shooting. I'm 17 years old, and I had to grow up every day thinking about what someone with a gun would do to me. And I'm incredibly outraged at what all of you adults haven't done.
Right.
And I think you're all cowards for not having solved this problem earlier. And soon I'll be able to vote. And you have been for many years. And so let's do that.
Yeah. Hard to even really follow that up, so I won't try to. We are going to talk about a bunch of different things on the bonus show. We are going to talk about a new policy on excessive force for police officers. We're going to talk about a whole bunch of other things. If you're interested, sign up at joinpacman.com.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best. The smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
WRCT. In sound from way out.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Nuclear Holocaust.
It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The idea that an 18-year-old can walk into a store and buy weapons of war designed and marketed to kill is, I think, just wrong. It just violates common sense.
President Biden plans to visit Uvalde, Texas, after an 18-year-old gunman shot dead 19 students and two teachers in a fourth-grade classroom. It was the deadliest school shooting in over a decade. We'll speak to the gun control group Giffords, named after Congressmember Gabby Giffords, the victim of another mass shooting. We will also speak to an Australian gun activist who helped rewrite Australia's gun laws after the Port Arthur massacre. Plus, we'll look at more at the Texas community of Uvalde and the role of Border Patrol in the region.
DHS has so far said that they won't enforce immigration law in Uvalde for the time being. But of course, whatever, we have no idea what that means moving forward.
And we speak to Patrick Coburn about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. He warns London and Washington are being propelled by hubris just as Putin was. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Vigils were held in Uvalde, Texas, Wednesday, a day after an 18-year-old gunman shot and killed 19 students and two teachers at the Robb Elementary School. It was the deadliest school shooting in the United States in over a decade. All the victims were in the same fourth-grade class. The White House says President Biden will visit Uvalde in the coming days. Meanwhile, chilling details have emerged about the events leading up to the massacre. Officials say the gunman lawfully purchased two semi-automatic assault rifles and up to 375 rounds of ammunition just last week after his 18th birthday. On Tuesday morning, he texted a teenage girl he'd befriended online in Germany, writing, "I'm going to shoot my grandmother." Then he wrote, "I just shot my grandma in her head," followed immediately by the message, "I'm a go shoot up a elementary school." Police say the gunman shot his way past an armed school security officer, then barricaded himself inside the school for over an hour, wounding two police officers before he was shot dead by a Border Patrol agent. Some parents report they tried to storm the school as they waited for police to respond, but were pushed back. The gunman was reportedly in that school between 40 minutes and an hour. On Wednesday, Texas gubernatorial candidate and former Democratic Congressmember Beto O'Rourke interrupted a press conference held by Texas Governor Greg Abbott in Uvalde. Video of the incident shows Beto approaching the stage and telling Abbott, "This is totally predictable when you choose not to do anything." Beto O'Rourke was shouted down by top Texas Republicans and escorted from the room by police. We'll play excerpts of that confrontation after headlines. Governor Abbott has declined to say whether he still plans to attend the National Rifle Association's 2022 annual meeting, which is set to open in Houston on Friday. Texas Republican Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and Republican Senator Ted Cruz still plan to attend, as does former President Donald Trump. He'll be the headliner on Friday night. World leaders continue to react in horror to the latest mass shooting in the United States. At the Vatican, Pope Francis said Wednesday he's heartbroken by the massacre in Texas.
It is time to say enough to the indiscriminate trafficking of weapons. Let us all make a commitment. Let us all make a commitment so that tragedies like this cannot happen again.
After headlines, we'll get the latest on the Texas elementary school massacre and speak with a gun activist who helped rewrite